This is a recording from the Jefferson Literary and Debating Society at the University of Virginia. On September 26, 2008, the Society hosted Nikolai Petro, professor of political science at the University of Rhode Island. Petro has written 8 books on Russian politics, has served as special assistant for policy in the U.S. State Department, and has also served as advisor to the mayor of the Russian city of Novgorod the Great. In addition to commenting in the International Herald Tribune, the Boston Globe, Christian Science Monitor, and Asia Times, Petro writes an occasional blog devoted to Russia at opednews.com.
My friend and esteemed political commentator, with whom I drove down this morning, Eric Jerome Sani, also a Herald member, following observation. When you think of Georgia, think of peaches. Well, I'm here to tell you, my friends, they're not always peachy in Georgia. The crisis that I'm talking about, that you all know about, erupted just a few short weeks ago. But it is possible now, even at this short reprieve, to establish what occurred, why it occurred, and what lessons can be learned. What happened is laid out in the timeline in front of you. Now I know it's very hard to read, and Brian, if you'd hold up the version that is available for you to download at my website, nice big print, please feel free at eripetro.net. Although I prefer Georgian and Western sources when it comes to elucidating the origins, they cannot hide the fact that on the night of August 7th, Georgia initiated a massive bombardment of Tsikhvali, a city of 30,000, that after this bombardment, it launched an assault with 13,000 soldiers, that 17 hours later, after 17,000 refugees had fled northward and hundreds killed, including 15 peacekeepers, Russia intervened, and after 3 days of fighting, routed the Georgian army, destroyed its war-making capability, and established a defense perimeter of several kilometers inside Georgian territory, which it will man under the terms of the peace accord until EU observers take their place. Now, why did it happen? All 4 English-speaking specialists on the region agree. I'll name them if you want in question answer. Agree that this is an ancient ethnic and political conflict exacerbated by Georgian nationalism, which Mikhail Saakashvili carefully nurtured and brought to a boil. The Ossetians joined the Russian Empire as an independent entity, but for convenience, the convenience of St. Petersburg, were joined to the governorship of Tiflis 40 years later. They were never happy with this decision, and on September 20th, 1989, declared their own South Ossetian Soviet Democratic Republic. On December 11th, 1990, the Georgian Supreme Soviet abolished South Ossetia's autonomous status and launched the first of 5 military assaults to reconquer the region. February 1991, March 1991, June 1992, June 2004, and the latest, August 2008. The first war was brought to an end by the signing of the Baganis Accords on June 24, 1992, which gave international sanction to the 500 CIS peacekeepers and handful of OSCE observers stationed there. The last war is the logical outcome of Mikhail Saakashvili's campaign pledge on July 20th, 2004, that he was ready to denounce the Baganis Accords if the Georgian flag did not fly over the South Ossetian capital. The rest of the English-speaking world, beyond those 4 experts, wonders mainly why this crisis exploded now. And 2 theories prevail. Theory number 1. This this was a premeditated Russian attack. In Washington, D.C., a revanchist Russia was itching for an opportunity to punish Georgia for wanting to join NATO, align with the United States, providing an alternative transit route for oil, and just being a democracy. That is why Russia took the side of the separatists and prevented the Georgian government from extending its authority into the region. This backed Georgia into a corner so that its only option was to tear up the ceasefire accord and reconquer these regions militarily. Now, this argument sounds compelling to Americans because it resonates with the familiar themes of the Cold War. Its weakness rests on the careful filtering out of key information in three ways.
First, it portrays Russia, in order to portray Russia as the aggressor, Russian peacekeeping efforts are filtered out as either insincere, and Russia is portrayed as unremittingly hostile to NATO, Western values, and democracy. Now, the second point, I think, is obvious if one reads the mainstream media. As proof of the first, you will note that the Dagomis Accords that detailed what is and is not allowed in the conflict zone is almost never cited. Rarely is it mentioned that this is an internationally sanctioned mission that over 16 years has cost the lives of 117 Russian peacekeepers, and that thanks to their efforts, according to the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, more than 45,000 Georgians have been able to return to their homes. Second, in order to portray Russia as a helpless Christian democracy raped by Russian barbarians, the actual sequence of events is carefully filtered. For Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, a leading candidate to be Barack Obama's Secretary of State, quote, "Exactly what happened in South Ossetia last week is unclear, but Russia's to blame." Senator McCain's foreign policy advisor, Robert Kagan, is more blunt. Quote, "The details of who did what to precipitate Russia's war against Georgia are not very important." End quote. Well, if aggression is unimportant, then the incident can just as easily be spun as a Russian trap. And voila, the Georgian aggression becomes Russian aggression. Third, in order to erase from public consciousness the long history of Georgian nationalism and replace it with an image of Georgia as, quote, as President Bush put it, the beacon of liberty, one needs to filter out entirely Ossetian history, language, identity, and demonize their efforts for independence, as New Yorker editor David Remnick did when he casually referred to it as, quote, a duchy run by the Russian Secret Service and criminal gangs. Well, if they're nothing but criminals and puppets, then they have no arguments, no rights, and cannot really be said to exist. As Lincoln Mitchell, a Central Asia specialist at Columbia, remarked in the New York Times, quote, "I don't think anybody really cares a lot about the South Ossetian people," end quote. Truer words were never spoken. Version two, this was a premeditated attack by Georgia. In this view, popular in Moscow, Saakashvili, frustrated by his inability to make progress in negotiations with the separatists, having seen his bid for NATO membership delayed because of these unresolved conflicts, and facing the possibility of a far less sympathetic political leadership in Washington after January, decided on a quick solution while the world's attention was diverted on the Beijing Olympics. The evidence for this argument can be broken down into incidents that occurred prior to August and incidents that occurred the first week of August as Georgia prepared to launch its attack on August 7th. Before August, upon becoming president in 2004, Saakashvili's first move in South Ossetia is to forcibly close the Ergneti market, a hub for trade in contraband goods that was the region's major source of livelihood. In May of that year, he sends troops into the buffer zone with South Ossetia and in August tries to seize it, but fails. A new ceasefire protocol is signed in November of 2004, but in February of 2005, Saakashvili denounces these agreements, increases the country's military budget 30 times, so that today it is almost 10% of the country's GDP, compared to less than 3% for the United States and Russia. The number of men under arms is increased by 46% in the last 2 years. As a matter of fact, his military budget comprises 70% of the total budget. Irakli Okruashvili, who served as defense minister under Saakashvili from 2004 to 2006, but now lives in exile in France in fear for his life, reports that he and the president worked out military plans to invade South Ossetia and Abkhazia in 2004. Okruashvili indeed was the author of the 2004 invasion plan. More evidence, in spring of 2007, Saakashvili sets up a parallel pro-Georgian government in South Ossetia and repeatedly rejects calls for a non-use of force agreement among all the parties, most recently in meetings with the German foreign minister on July 17th of this year. And at the beginning of July, Georgia shuts off the main water supplies for Tsinkvali. And this continues through the beginnings of hostility in August. Now, the very week of the attack, what occurs? After completing joint exercises with 1,000 U.S. troops, this is at the end of July, Saakashvili does not order the troops to return to their barracks. Instead, he concentrates the artillery brigade that would begin firing on Tsinkvali on August 7th in Gori, which will be the main staging ground for Georgian military operations. Secondly, hackers shut down South Ossetian news sites on August 5th, 2 days before the attack. As soon as hostilities are launched, Georgia shuts down access to all RU internet domains and all Russian cable channels, the only source of alternative information accessible to most Georgians, and this continues to this day. There is a systematic policy of duplicity on the part of Georgian officials who, on the very week of the attack, as their forces and artillery move into position, repeatedly state that Georgia has no plans to attack, that indeed there have been no serious clashes since August 2nd. An internal OSCE report obtained by the German magazine Spiegel concludes, quote, Saakashvili lied 100% to all of us, the Europeans and the Americans, end quote. Georgian peacekeepers, apparently warned of the impending attacks, left their posts on August 7th and subsequently joined the attack with the Georgian army. NATO sources briefed by the Georgian general staff last week in September regarded as suspicious that the Georgian government never appealed to the UN or to the OSCE through regular diplomatic channels, but took 5 days to appeal for NATO assistance and instead focused their efforts on the US media. And there is the notable sophistication of that media campaign. Writing in The Nation, Mark Ames describes one telling incident, an investor call set up between 50 leading Western investment bankers and Georgian Prime Minister Lado Gurginidze. immediately after the attack began. I'd like to quote briefly from this article. Quote, Lather is a former banker himself, so he knew that by framing the conflict for the most influential bankers and analysts in New York, that these power brokers would then write up reports and go on CNBC and argue Lado Gurganidze's talking points. It was brilliant. And now you start seeing the American media shift its coverage from calling it Georgia invading Ossetian territory to the new spin, that it's Russian imperial aggression against tiny little Georgia. End quote. Such a large conference call with busy people suggests, he says, significant planning. These are things that aren't set up on an hour's notice, Ames notes. But one question that puzzles many is why tiny Georgia would ever attack big Russia. It seems crazy. Until one reads Georgia's deputy defense minister, Batu Kutelia, in the Financial Times, admitting that there were absolutely no contingency plans for a Russian military response. The Georgian army expected to deal only with the South Ossetian militia, which it heavily outgunned and outnumbered. One of the reasons may be that Saakashvili misinterpreted the frequent pronouncements of Western sympathy and support for his regime as a green light to resolve this issue once and for all. According to post facto U.S. State Department accounts, in early August, the U.S. was having regular discussions with the Georgian leadership and answering direct questions from them about using military force against Ossetia. Astonishingly, none of these discussions raised any sort of red flag about, well, Georgia's desire to use military force against Ossetia. Moreover, nobody in the U.S. government saw any connection between these persistent questions about how America would respond to a Georgian attack and the extraordinary pace of Georgia's military buildup. Is it any surprise, then, to find U.S. officials later saying, quote, the Georgians figured it was better to ask forgiveness later, but not ask for permission first, end quote. But while mixed signals, and this is the official line, mixed signals came from state, a clear go-ahead was apparently the message from the vice president's office. David Phillips, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, told the Los Angeles Times that, quote, Saakashvili's buddies in the White House and the office of the vice president kept egging him on, end quote. Dimitri Symes, president of the Nixon Center, confirms that the message given by the vice president's office, as well as by people like Richard Holbrooke, was that it was Saakashvili's opposition to Moscow that mattered most to them. And the more he could aggravate them, the more the U.S. would support him. Coincidentally, no doubt, one of Cheney's senior advisors, Joseph R. Wood, was in Tbilisi just days before the Georgians launched their attack. Saakashvili might very well have concluded that with the political leadership of the world at the Beijing Olympics, it would be days before any sort of organized response would take place. And a blitzkrieg that quickly replaced the political leadership in South Ossetia would ultimately be welcomed by the West. His former defense minister summarized the strategy. Quote, Saakashvili's offensive only aimed at taking Tsinkvali because he thought the U.S. would block a Russian reaction through diplomatic channels, end quote. Had this blitzkrieg worked, I think his calculation would have been correct. The ceasefire resolutions introduced by Russia 6 hours before any Russian troops were introduced, that the U.S. and Great Britain blocked because Georgia did not yet control the situation on the ground, would have been supported. And any attempt by Russia later to reverse Georgia's the Georgian gains would have been condemned as aggression, naked aggression. The situation after Saakashvili's fifth failure to resolve the issue by force, however, looks very different. His insistence that he will try again, along with America's precipitous pledge to rebuild Georgia's army. At its height this year, Georgia's defense spending was $1 billion. But in a recent interview with the New York Times, Georgia's defense minister, David Kedzerashvili, suggested that now twice as many troops and a modern air defense network were, of course, necessary for a total cost of $8 to $9 billion. This has forced Russia into resolving the issue of the status of these two regions unilaterally, recognizing them as independent states and signing defense treaties with them. So where do we go from here? I think Dmitry Symes has framed the choices before us very well. We can either figure out how to, as he puts it, translate the resurgence of Russian power and Russian will from a factor of confrontation into a new impulse for the development of Russian-American relations, or we can use it to establish a deep and long-lasting fissure in our relations. Here is why I think we should do the former. First, we need Russia more than they need us. As a growing part of international commerce, Russia is increasingly able to leverage financial interests in ways that can help or hurt the economies of the U.S. and Europe. The recent fall in the Russian stock market, which I suspect, but have no proof, was partly manipulated by U.S. policies aimed at punishing Russia, is very stupid. People who live in glass houses should not throw stones. As former German Chancellor Gerhard Schröder put it, quote, Russia has an Asian alternative. Europe does not, end quote. Secondly, Russia is vital to our energy security. Even if we built every pipeline, drilled every new source imaginable, our demand for Russian natural gas, Russian oil, Russian mineral resources would increase, not decrease. The diversification touted by many would lessen our reliance on a single source, but it would not diminish the need for that source. Third, Russia is vital to the war on terror. It is the one ally able and willing to provide us with reliable supply routes into Afghanistan. You can forget about Pakistan now that we bombed them, okay? Fourth, Russia is vital to dealing with the effects of global warming. Negotiating fair access to Arctic resources is simply not possible without Russia's support. Add, in addition to its strategic resources, the fact that it will become, by the end of the 21st century, a major global supplier of that rarest of commodities, fresh water. And it is easy to understand why Russia champions these issues in the G8. And fifth, Russia is ever more popular around the globe. Together with Brazil, China, and India, it is gathering more and more support for multipolarity in international affairs at the expense of the United States. As Kishore Mukhabani, the Dean of Public Policy at the National University of Singapore, recently wrote in a widely commented upon essay in the Financial Times, quote, it is critical for the West to learn the right lessons from Georgia. It needs to think strategically about the limited options it has. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, Western thinkers assumed the West would never need to make geopolitical compromises. It could dictate terms. Now it must recognize reality. The combined Western population in North America, the European Union, and Australasia is about 10% of the world's population. The remaining 90% have gone from being objects of world history to subjects. The Financial Times headline, this is still part of the quote, the Financial Times headline of August 18th proclaimed, quote, West is united over Georgia, end quote. It should have read, quote, rest of the world faults West over Georgia, end quote. Why? A lack of strategic thinking, end quote. Sadly, our strategic thinkers are mired in Cold War stereotypes that block us from working together even on the things we both want. Few people today remember that the U.S. and Russia worked together to bring Saakashvili to power, and that Vladimir Putin helped him settle his conflict in Adjaria, another region of Georgia, in 2004. Had we persisted in working together rather than at cross purposes, Abkhazia and southern Ossetia could very well have been part of Georgia today. To get beyond Cold War stereotypes, the Western media needs to stop filtering out good news about Russia. Think about how different our political discourse, our political options would be if Americans even knew that the vast majority of Russia's economic growth comes not from natural resources, but from increases in productivity and the expansion of the private sector. Or that the number of NGOs under Putin has increased from 100,000 to more than 600,000. Or that 95% of all media in Russia today is privately owned, with the exception of television. That the judiciary rules against the government in 80% of complaints brought by private citizens, or that there are 14 nationally registered political parties, all of which receive public funding and free airtime to campaign. And the list can go on. The next president can mend relations or continue the current dead-end course. The latter choice will damage Russia less than it will damage the U.S., because Russia is committed to globalization and multipolarity, while the central paradigm in Washington is still about finding some way to maintain American hegemony. Accommodating the emerging economic powers of the world, Brazil, Russia, China, and India, adapting to their expectations and values instead of confronting them is not a popular stance in Washington. But unless change comes soon, when it does come, it will be forced upon us at great cost to America's democratic institutions and global standing. Thank you very much. So some of you have questions. If you want me to, I'll just think of them.
We're going to move into the question and answer portion of the lecture. So if anybody has any questions, please feel free to ask.
Or critiques.
Thanks again for joining us this evening. What are your impressions of fundamental rights? Well, I believe the background is actually a Russian specialist. What are your
Soviet specialist.
right,
well.
What are your impressions?
She is definitely, I mean, as far as I can tell from the outside, she seems to have taken a lead in defining the administration stance, which is to sharpen confrontation, to take the stance that we have a vital stake in Georgia, and the Russians should not tread on it, and there was a violation. I think the State Department line is the line that she is promoting. I just disagree with it. So I could also add as a bit of background that she and the current foreign minister of Russia, Sergei Lavrov, have had a lot of back and forth about, we're trying to tell you, send you this message, and you're not listening. Oh, that's not what we want to hear. You know, this is our line, and this is what you should do. So for years, now there's been an inability. They seem to be talking, but they're not really communicating. And a couple of years ago, the phrase that came out of Washington, which was the popular phrase then, I think it still is today, is values deficit or values gap. In other words, we Western democracies have certain values. And Russia can't be part of our alliance, can't be a true friend, because of a certain unspecified values gap. That's something that Lavrov on principle rejects. And I think the whole idea of the notion that Russian foreign policy is promoting a multipolarity is one that does not assume that there is an appropriate standard of values that the West imposes. And that's just wrong from the get-go. So I just didn't want to talk about that. Yeah.
Thank you again for your time. I'm inclined to agree with your argument that America's current posture is both counterproductive and highly suspect. However, to what degree do you think that Russia has taken an equally antagonistic stance? And as a follow-up to that, to what degree can you improve relations, or how can relations be improved via Russian actions in addition to a change in U.S. policy?
Russia believes that the history of its peacekeeping initiatives were leading to results up through February of 2005. What happened in February 2005 was, I should say, November of 2004, after the fourth failed attack, the prime minister of the time, Zurabzhvania, Georgian prime minister, signed a very comprehensive peace accord with South Ossetia, in particular, it was just South Ossetia. And it was not just a peace accord with the current president there, Eduard Kokoity, but it was actually a step-by-step process for regulating their relations within the context of remaining part of Georgia. And this obligated Georgia to pursuing a peaceful path. Zurabzhvania died in his apartment due to poisoning. His radiator leaked and he died in February of 2005. So some people look at this and go, something not so kosher about that. After that, Saakashvili takes a different tack and decides that the real way to resolve this issue is to sweep the region clean of these bandits, essentially. And Russia resists that, and not only resists that, but becomes increasingly hostile to the efforts, to the Georgian regime. So there is really no further progress beyond 2005 in communications between the two countries on this, on not just on this issue, on a host of issues. The one thing that I could say, I've looked back at the record carefully and tried to figure out if there was something uniquely that Russia did to bolster, to provoke Georgia. Because most things are tit for tat. Georgia, they suspended imports of wine. Well, the Georgian minister said Russians would drink anything, even fecal matter. Okay, that's not a big selling point, right, for your wine. So, then you can give that to the minister of agriculture and say, maybe we ought to inspect all Georgian wine for fecal matter. It's just a stupid thing to do. There is one incident in March of this year, after Kosovo was recognized as independent by the United States and a handful of European countries. Clearly, and I think Putin says as much now, in retaliation, but as a sort of one of those, diplomatic, as he understood it, as a diplomatic signal, raises relations with South Ossetia and Abkhazia a notch by lifting the embargo that had been agreed upon with them for 16 years, including Russian goods. So that was lifted, and to make the lifting of the embargo more effective, ostensibly, they also sent troops to fix the railways that connect two Georgian ports, in Abkhazia, two Georgian ports. So they went in, they fixed the railroad and left. And anyway, those are two clear incidents initiated by Russia. And the Georgians go ballistic over that and, you know, withdraw their ambassador and all sorts of things. Yes, these are clearly incidents. Whether, I think it's worth asking, is this an appropriate response to those? Again, 16 years have taken place. There are Putin cites UN resolutions which say, we want to impose embargo, but we don't want to hurt the population, so this is kind of done with that. But it was clearly a signal, I think, not so much at the Georgians, which I suspect Russia at that time saw as a fairly stable situation, not going to change very soon, but aimed at the United States and the Europeans, saying, look, there's no difference between Kosovo and South Ossetia. I mean, just, you know, get real. And so if you do this, well, we're not going to go, you know, 100% the same way, but we can take steps too. Okay, this isn't a one-sided game where all the cards are on your side of the table. You've got allies here, and we can squeeze them. Okay, so, but that's about the only thing that I clearly identify as a Russian provocation in this incident. Others have pointed to other provocations. I see them as more tit for tat, sort of like one side did one thing, another side did another thing, and back and forth. This is the one incident that I can identify where Russia clearly took the initiative in putting pressure on Georgia. Yeah.
Thank you again for your speech, Mr. Petro. I have a question. Could you please comment on the Defense Department's Mr. Edelman and Mr. Fried commenting that they warned Georgia not to provoke Russia militarily?
Right.
And they warned them months and months, and how that correlates to a direct contradiction between apparently what the State Department and the White House is saying and what the Department of Defense is saying.
There you have it. What's the truth? Who's telling the truth? Who knew what? When? That's a big question. And there are even more tells, if you will, in this incident. For example, I caught an off-reference which is puzzling to me. In The Economist, if you write me an email, I can send you the exact quote. I don't want to give it now because I might get the dates wrong. But in an editorial in The Economist, they cite Matthew Breza, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for European Eurasian Affairs, who's the point man in negotiating with the Georgians on this matter and with Russia on this matter, as taking a call at 2 a.m. on August 7th, where he is told that the Georgians are going to launch an attack. This is by Georgia. And they said, we're going to launch the attack. And he says, don't do it. But 2 a.m. on August 7th, if he's in D.C., is not the right time. It's 6 hours. It's 12 hours too early. It's 12 hours before the attack began. Now, it's very puzzling because, maybe The Economist got the date wrong. But none of the possible alternatives fit unless Breza was not in Washington at the time. And that's certainly possible, and I have to track this down. It's peculiar that none of the references that state where that discuss his whereabouts mention him not being in Washington at that time. Well, it just leads to the confusion over who said what to whom. That's one side of the story. The other side of the story, of course, is what did Saakashvili hear? Or what did Saakashvili and his advisors hear? It's, you know, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, that's kind of mid-level, okay? If he says one thing, and then the Vice President says, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, you're not quite sure what the real message is and what sort of support you're likely to get. Who do you, you're kind of, you have room for maneuver, I would say, as a political actor. that's
I just think there's a lot of unclarity about exactly the role the United States took in these matters. And I'm sure you'll have a lot of actors who claim that they were doing specific things for the right reasons and then they were misunderstood on the other side. And that seems to be, as I understand Secretary Fried's testimony, it's the defense line is that. We don't know what the Georgians were really doing, but we heard them very convincingly tell us on the phone that they thought such and such was happening. We just took their word for it. Is that, you know, that I can tell you that a lot of the European press accounts thinks that's a load of hooey, that the Americans didn't know what was happening in August 7th, especially because they just had 1,000 troops there 2 weeks ago. And you're not about to send 1,000 troops in harm's way, I think. Yes, back there.
Highly corrupt, highly controlled by bureaucratic people and billionaires. I guess a broader question, how do you respond to a situation like that with Russia emerging in the new world order as well, and us saying that we're trying to fight for the people of Russia when the Russian government is really expressing?
Well, I think it's a much more mixed picture. And there may be good reasons for that. Maybe that the reporting on reporting tends to be about bad things that happen. I mean, if good things are happening, I don't know what's happening in New Zealand. I mean, I just assume happy things are happening, right? In New Zealand, that's why we never hear about it. Finland, okay, yeah, 10 people got killed. Okay, then we hear about Finland. But that doesn't make you think, boy, Finns, you know, give them a gun and it's crazy time. No, because kind of we have another, I guess, set of assumptions about Finland. Not that we actually know much about Finland. But it is a lot of what is reported is accurate about Russia. But it is accurate for that segment of Russian society, for a fraction of the reality of Russia, which is on a day-to-day basis, much more complicated. And there are, you know, where did these billionaires who run everything come from? Well, from the effects of the private market and people making money. Now, maybe they made their money illegally, maybe this, and then you can complain and you can say, well, what about the laws? What about, all these things are true. But it should also make you think, I think, how have things changed so dramatically that all of a sudden, Russia has more billionaires than, well, almost any other country. and certainly per capita, I think almost more than any country. I forget what the statistics are recently. You know, third? Okay. And, you know, all you have to do is really visit Russia. And another thing, I lived for 2 years with my family, in a provincial city. So, and we don't get to Moscow much. You know, big city lights don't really thrill us. Now, Moscow, you can say, is like New York. It's got, you know, everything and most expensive city in the world, $1,000 hotel rooms. Yeah, galore. But that's not the rest of Russia. The rest of Russia is black. Well, I can tell you, it's not, at least not everywhere. Yeah, there are places somewhere comparable to, I don't know, Appalachia in Russia. But Novgorod is a very decent place to live. We go there every summer and, you know, and have a great time. And they have everything you might want. And it's just a normal place. Daniel Treisman wrote an article, one of the few articles in Foreign Affairs that I guess made sense to me about Russia. When the title was, Russia's a normal country. Okay. That doesn't mean a perfect country. It means a country with flaws and a country with good aspects. Okay, we list all the flaws. Now let's list the good aspects. Where do we get that information? We can't find it. You can find it on the web, but you have to look. And you have to And that's unfortunate, because I think it should be presented, here's the bad things, here's the good things, you make a decision, not through an editorial filter like the Washington Post, which is, I mean, let's be honest, guys, Russophobic. There's just no other way to describe the political agenda of the Washington Post. I mean, you can't read the words Russian without reading fascist in the same sentence. That's just crazy. I mean, you don't make friends that way. Even if you, you know, even with fascists. Yeah. Well, at the main, at the meeting in Kennebunkport, Putin threw open this idea of having a joint station in Azerbaijan, Gabala. And yeah, it was clearly a PR ploy. It clearly caught the administration off guard, so they said, well, sounds like a neat idea, you know, we'll look into it. And they looked into it and said, no, we can't do that. It's a technical issue, and I don't know whether it's a good idea or a bad idea. I hear some people say it's a good idea for these reasons, other people say it's a bad idea for these reasons. As a political position to take, I think if we had said, yeah, we can do that, and maybe we'll do something else too, but we'll do that, so we have some sort of common discourse on this area, and you can see what we're doing, we can see what you're doing, that's, I think politically that would be a good idea. I think militarily it makes sense. If you want shields, hey, the more's the better, right? Let's have that shield out there in Poland and Czechoslovakia and Lithuania maybe and Azerbaijan, which is closer. It has different functions or whatever its specifics are. Let's have that too. No. So it was maybe never meant to be, or somehow it... I think I guess theoretically it's still on the table, but there doesn't seem to be any movement on it. Yes.
Sorry, I had to stand up to mute again. Thanks very much for your time. You mentioned the responses of Senators McCain and Obama after the thing. If you were working for one of them and could craft a pro-Russian narrative for them to spin to the American people, I wonder what that would be. And as a follow-up to that, we're all bombarded, but is a compelling one. How indicative do you think the Russian-Georgian interaction is of larger, you know, former Soviet countries with Russia in the future?
Well, yeah. Well, let me just say to the notion that Georgia is a democracy, there are dozens of articles out there that debunk that whole theory. And it doesn't help to have a lot of your main political opponents and your richest political opponents found dead in London in Tbilisi or just in exile. I mean, every member of the political opposition in Georgia has fled, except for Nino Budzhanidze, who is back there now basically trying to oust, well, okay, basically trying to shake things up. And who knows how that'll work out. But I think the effort by the Georgian opposition, sadly, will be misinterpreted in Washington as a help to Russia. And doesn't need to be, necessarily. What I would say to the candidates, I think I would start with some simple phrase like Russia is a normal country, and let's work on where we can, let's identify where we can cooperate. And I personally would downplay the whole values conflict as not helping in any case, and not really anything we can discuss. So why bring it up? Now, unfortunately, my sense of the folks in the campaign that I know, and particularly on Obama's campaign, who was the change candidate, are that they're not changing anything with respect to Russia. The agenda is not Bush's agenda, it's Clinton's agenda, which is bombard them with human rights literature. That's how I read Mike McFaul's 12-point statement, it's great for me. I get more money to do, to travel, to be an observer to elections, to do all sorts of stuff, okay? But there's more money for me, but I don't think Russians could care less. And frankly, Ukrainians either, things like that. There are a few programs when they're very specifically targeted, when people on the ground there need them, and I was part of some of those in my region. I mean, at a regional level, yes, it makes sense when a specific judge needs specific help understanding points of the law or organizational capacities that he's never been exposed to. That makes sense. But like here's a leaflet. Call me if you have questions. I got to go back to Moscow now. No, that's just stupid and completely ineffective. So I think I would start with something like, let's treat Russia as a normal country. Lots of countries have problems. Maybe they're not our friends. Maybe they're not our enemies. We'll see how it goes. And I would try to distance myself. I think this is the only realistic stance to take. I mean, realistic advice to give. Is I would burden myself with as little baggage of previous administrations as I could. And come up and say, I would just come out with a statement that says, we're not bound by the ideologies. If we use the word ideology and say, we're not going to take an ideological stance, that is a code word that they're looking at, because they're looking at our foreign policy. I'm just reading Russian foreign policy statements. They're looking at our foreign policy and saying, you guys are just like the Soviet Union. Okay? It's all about ideology for you. Democracy, you got to come here and ram it down people's throats, and you want this and you want that, and it's got to be today. And that's not a solution. That's not the way you deal with countries in general, and particularly not in what they see the world becoming, which is a multipolar world. That's a bigger issue. Should we be struggling to keep America in our unipolar moment or not? Probably not, but I can understand the argument and the attractiveness of that position. Back in the day, Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote a piece before becoming National Security Advisor for Jimmy Carter in foreign policy, in which he talked about a new global architecture and how it was in America's advantage to begin to structure that new global architecture because we couldn't get away from it. That seems to me a sensible position to revisit today. But that's not where he's going with respect to Russia. He's back in Cold War mode. Yeah. And then the gentleman back there.
Thank you very much for your presentation once again, Mr. Petro. I was wondering if I can take you back to the little issue of how, if at all, secession of South Ossetia and Abkhazia can be resolved if there's any way that these countries in some sort of a confederal or federal solution could be brought back to Georgia, because I think that's otherwise there's no way to bridge this gap between Georgia and Russia. I was wondering if you can.
Oh, time heals all wounds. And no, from Russia's perspective, the issue is resolved. Now it's just a matter of the rest of the world catching up. And I must say, for all intents and purposes, maybe somebody can come up with some extravagant way to put pressure on Russia, I just can't think of it. But they're in the catbird seat. I mean, they had all the cards. They made the decision, and they can totally support their decision, militarily, economically, on the ground. It is doubtful in my mind that the Europeans can sustain indignation longer than 2 weeks. and then it'll be business as usual. Although, Condi Rice, she's like out of a job in 6 weeks. So who cares what she says? I'm sorry to be so blunt, but we're talking about politics, right? So life goes on, and Russia has made a decision which changes the international status for these two regions. Now, America can throw a bunch of monkey wrenches into the works, but again, it's nothing different. For example, for 2 years running, the United States has denied visas to go to the UN for Abkhaz missions, for the very UN mission which is in Abkhazia. So that's because we don't want to recognize them. Well, so if they don't do it again, how's that change anything? It just makes them look, you know, more obtuse, because now we have a higher, you know, there. It's a little notch up in terms of international recognition. But lawyers will debate about that. So I don't see it. You know, Russia, I think, has pretty much set the terms of the debate. There's no way. I don't see any way of going back, and I don't know of any precedents, even internationally, for going back and saying, "Oops, you're not really a state. My mistake." By any country, you know, even if it was only one or two, or in this case, two countries that have recognized this state. Yes.
Yeah, thank you for your very thoughtful comments, and I have two short questions for you. I myself am a descendant of Russian imperial officers who served in the Caucasus. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
The only non-Slavs, or almost the only non-Slavs, yeah, who are Orthodox Christians. If you recall, you know, Leo Tolstoy, Warren Beatty, and General Bagrationi, and so on and so forth, you know, Georgians were always considered as, you know, brother for us.
Yeah, yeah.
What happened, I mean, what was the turning point when, you know, two Orthodox Christian nations, yeah, suddenly, I mean, became all enemies?
Yeah, yeah. This is a very painful subject. This is a very painful subject for Russians, and I think for Georgians. And I know a lot of Georgians, and we all, in the emigration, you always grew up with Georgians, and they were always part of the general community of the Russian immigration. Well, I can tell you the stance of the Russian government on this position seems to be a sensible one, which is, we do not have anything against Georgia. It's Saakashvili and his group. They're the ones who are driving this in a certain direction. So as long as he is in charge, we cannot have the kind of normal relations. I don't know whether you caught the article. I think it was in the New York Times. It was about Tina Kandeladze, and with a quote at the end by Zurab Tsirteli. About, you know, who's to blame and how it feels today to be here and there. And they were quite optimistic, actually, at the end, where they said, this is a relationship which is like a husband and wife relationship, okay? Obviously, we're not going anywhere. We've been together for hundreds of years, and we're going to be together. So we have a conflict right now, but later on, our relationship will flower again under different circumstances with new people. That's all we can hope for. It is troubling to me. I don't know whether you caught an article in by Patriarch Ilya II in Le Croix, a French newspaper. He has been very much defended by the Russian Orthodox Church, saying, you know, he's not a nationalist, he has not made statements. The statements that he made, not so much with respect to Russia, certainly, but with respect to what are these Ossetian people, and are they really people, or are they people from the Northern Caucasus who don't really belong in Georgia and should be, you know. All of this is troubling to me, and I think a lot needs to be worked through in terms of if Georgia is to be a multi-ethnic country, and I think it needs to be, it needs to identify these other ethnic groups and well, being somehow find a way to bring them in to being, feeling welcome in these territories. Maybe Abkhazia simply had too strong a sense of their own identity. I'm not that keen a specialist to know. There are certainly indications of that. But everyone says that Ossetia had no reason to leave until 91. And they wouldn't have left. And even afterwards, up through 2005, they were willing to consider confederation. I don't see how that's going to occur now.
In second, short question.
Yeah.
You mentioned, that information about Russia and the United States is filtered out, and believe me, I'm teaching at this university for many years, and almost 1,500 students graduated from my courses, and usually students come with certain stereotypes about Russia. Mm-hmm. And they normally are negative.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that one of the reasons is that in the United States we do not have pro-Russian lobby. We have very powerful anti-Russian lobby. Almost every country has very powerful lobby. Chinese, Israelis, Armenians, Ukrainians, Lithuanians, and so on. Russians, the anti-Russian lobby. And I think this is Russia's responsibility to do something, to improve the situation. Because look at, Russian language, TV programs in the United States. They are virulently anti-Russian.
Yeah. Well, I think that is something to do, and they are beginning to do that. I doubt that lobbying is as effective. It's certainly not a comprehensive strategy. I think education, more information, lobbying for specific, that's useful. But I think it will just take a long time. And my optimism is with just time. It will clearly be a different world when no one can remember what the Cold War was about. I mean, really about. Today you can kind of get the ideology and you have to remember about Marxism-Leninism. But the people in power, they lived through that. And that's their baseline. They go back to it automatically. If there's a conflict, aha, this is what I know it's about. But when you don't have that baseline, you can have a different sort of discourse. And one of the things was pointed out to me, I was on a chat, reading some chat stuff on this subject, and they pointed out that Russians form the largest group of students in British public schools. That's the private elite high schools that are the feeder colleges for Oxford and Cambridge. And they form something like an enormous percent, like 20% of the total. Now, when these kids grow up, and they 20, 30 years from now, and it's Vovik remembers Buffy from college, and Buffy's foreign minister, and Vovik is foreign minister of Russia, they're going to have a completely different relationship from Kandi Rice and Sergei Lavrov. I mean, this is like, one can call up the other and say, hey, do you remember the days when we used to, tear down the such and such, the old bridge? Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's the kind of relationship that exists among Western elites, the core. Russia has never been part of that, ever. Certainly not in the Cold War, and they're just beginning now. But for them to become full members, it'll take a while still. When that happens, doors will burst open that just seem impenetrable today. It's kind of hard to imagine what that'll be like, but I can only imagine that, when people cannot imagine someone being an enemy, there's no reason to think that way, whereas in the Cold War it was obvious you were evil and things like that. We're kind of in a transition period still, and it's too easy to just fall back. But the further we get away from it, the less. I don't think a lot of this conflict makes sense to you guys. Does it? I mean, only in terms of a Cold War that you don't... I mean, you didn't even...
I didn't.
Yeah. At least that's my sense, and I teach a Cold War class. That's my sense of it. So I'm optimistic in that sense, and, forward to the future. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Great talk.
Thank you. Oh. So, yeah. And for more pro-Russian propaganda, find my website, npetro.net, and you'll get the timeline, and yeah, I might post something about this, too.